Blog Talk Radio.
Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, very good.
I'm going to introduce Paul. Paul Victor Vasquez is with us this evening. Paul is the head of the United Stewardship Alliance. And Paul, why don't we take a few minutes and let's talk about the alliance, and we want to talk a little bit about your U-Challenge that you've got going on. But before we jump into what the U-Challenge is all about, let's just talk a little bit about what the alliance is.
Sure. United Stewardship Alliance is a nonprofit organization designed to help people and organizations promote and achieve peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow. And we do this by providing them with tools to do so. We're fairly new in the phase that we're in. The idea has been around for quite a while, but we've just started as a nonprofit about 5 years ago, and we've been building slowly, but it's been growing every year.
Now, does this group have a relationship with any other organization? From the name, United Stewardship Alliance, it sounds quasi, like it almost sounds like it might be having a religious affiliation or something like that, or is it just a completely standalone group?
No, we're a standalone group. Part of the idea is that no matter what religion, race, creed, color you are, that you can get behind the ideas of peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow. It's kind of to be that space in between, you know, religion and government, where everybody can get together and help make the world a better place. So we don't have to fight over, you know, your creeds and those kinds of things. But as long as we can agree to those three things, that we care about peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow, and we're willing to do things to try to promote that in our world, that's what we're looking to do.
Okay, Stephen, have you rejoined us?
I have, and I'm going to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. Sorry, guys.
Okay, all right. Well, Paul, by tradition, we have a technical glitch with every show. This one was more dramatic than most, just to let you know that we brought you in on a night when we honored a time-worn Fast Forward Radio tradition here. So sorry about that. So you were saying, I mean, these are as close to universal values, I guess, as people could possibly look for.
I hope so, and of course, in relation to maybe the singularity or the advances in technology, these are kind of the core values that I would hope our society is able to have, even through technological innovations. So if we're creating AIs or whatever, we hope that these values are the ones that are instilled in the future technology that comes. In whatever future we have, we hope that these are ideals that follow us. And, of course, for that to happen, we actually have to take steps in our lives right now to start creating a society that's that way.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the things I always think about with the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, you know, the quest for friendly AI. One of the key things that I think we should be doing as a civilization is modeling friendly behavior for the AIs that come, right? You know, I mean, we need to do more than that, obviously. We need to be designing them in such a way that they're going to be instilled with those kinds of values. But actually just having those values ourselves and actively pursuing them seems like at least one strong way of making sure that, or at least trying to make sure that those intelligences eventually have the same kinds of values. So let's talk a little bit about what is the U challenge and what's your you've got one going on now. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, a U challenge is a challenge that we put forth to all the stewards to make the world a better place. It's one of our tools. And this month's U challenge is to write up at least 15 compliments and post it on the event page on our Facebook group. And the idea here is one of our stewards, as we call our members, wanted to have a challenge where we wrote in a journal. And I thought, well, is there a way we can do more for the collective well-being than just writing in a journal? Writing in a journal seems like something that's just going to help that particular individual. Right, who's actually doing
right.
it. But if we right. can couple that, say, with a positive influence, so if it's a thank you, and then we also bring in that we're actually thanking somebody who's done something to make the world a better place, then we begin to accelerate the good that one act is doing. Now, on top of this, what we're doing now with our U challenges, it's something that we're starting up again. We've had challenges before, but now we're actually adding on another layer in that whoever gives the most notes out, the most compliment notes on that event page, will get U votes. And these U votes are then good that they can then turn around and give to any nonprofit organization that turns into real valuable money that they can decide to designate to any nonprofit organization that they wish. So
very cool.
We incentivize them too to make the world a better place.
So saying nice things ultimately gets converted into doing good deeds here, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
Very
I mean,
cool.
You know, and this one U challenge, it may seem maybe a little antiquated or a little pedestrian for some people, although I would like to say that it's these small, simple things that eventually build a quality of character that we hope to build in each of us individually. But on top of that, say if that's not something somebody's interested in, they can always donate to United Stewardship Alliance, and we can turn around and make those U votes that then help other people do these things that maybe, you know, maybe you're not interested in doing, but you still want to help. So,
okay.
And there's lots of ways we find people can help.
Yeah, so anybody who doesn't feel like they can cough up 15 compliments, maybe they can cough up $15 and help support some of the causes that the U votes go towards. Now, I'm really intrigued by this idea. So you put 50, so you go to the event page and you pay your 15 compliments. Who are they aimed at? Other stewards or anyone you want or
anyone you want?
Okay.
Anyone you want. There's the guideline is it has to be somebody real.
Okay.
And it has to be a specific thing that you're thanking them for. So if it's very general, you know, it's not going to count.
Right.
You know, I thank you for being a wonderful person. Well, that's nice, but we want a specific incident because
yeah, something wonderful that person did. Right. I got you.
Yeah,
okay. Or something
because
wonderful about that person. Yeah.
Well, we're looking for a specific incident of something that they've done.
Okay.
Because what that does is it helps to promote these types of good behaviors or positive some behaviors in society.
So really, instead of constructive criticism, this is like complimenting. It has to be something that they can go, oh, well, that's great. Okay, I'll do that again.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Rewarding the good behavior for once. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, so folks who want to participate in this, you know what, Paul, why don't you go ahead and put a link into the Alliance in our chat room, and we'll also add that to the to the show notes. So people who want to find United Stewardship Alliance and want to participate in the U Challenge, or just generally get involved with United Stewardship Alliance, this is your time to do so, folks. Start supporting, bringing goodness into the world, which I think just about as fine a charter as any organization I can think of. So, fantastic. Well, it's great having you with us, Paul. And I think you're going to stick around
and talk
about some of these other topics with us as well this evening. Is that right?
Sure. Happy to participate in any way you like.
All right. Well, it's great having you. So, Stephen, before you dematerialized in a rather dramatic fashion there, I think you were talking a little bit about self-driving cars.
Well, this was something that actually Paul brought up right before the show got cranked up. And, Paul, tell us a little bit about that conversation you were having, self-driving car.
Yeah. So we're sitting around in a group of people, and we were just chatting, and I was just, you know, I've been driving so much, and I just expressed, you know, how excited I was when self-driving cars would be prevalent in society. You know, I didn't have to worry about other people going crazy on the road. I could kick back a little bit, and the guy just totally belittled me and said this would never happen, and then I was off my rocker. And I was shocked, you know, because this is something that, you know, has even started appearing in some news. You know, I think they had just passed that law in the Arizona.
Nevada?
Nevada, you're right. Nevada, about the license plates. They'd just done that. And so I thought, you know, more people would be up on that. But I was astonished at how quickly he berated me for my ignorance.
For your knowledge of what's happening in the world. And, Stephen, weren't you saying that another state has just taken some legal step in this direction? Is that right?
A legislator in Sacramento, in California, has introduced a bill modeled after Nevada's, and really, it's pretty you know, conservative in a way. They're not like saying you can throw out a Google car can, you know, take a trip by itself or anything like that. It has to have a licensed driver behind the wheel in Nevada. I think the bill that they're looking to pass in California are two people to be present in the car. And so that's, you know, I think it's important, though, that, you know, you have a lot of highway and real circumstances, you know, city driving, country, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, to test these vehicles. These vehicles need a large-scale, real-world test, and I appreciate those states doing that.
Stephen, we're getting a report. You sounded okay to me, but apparently you're breaking up a little bit again. So I don't know what's going on.
I'm sorry, guys. I don't know what to do about it.
Do you know this always happens whenever there's a transit of Venus? It's the next day, and then we have audio problems with Stephen. It's just the weirdest thing. I've never understood that connection, but we should be good then till 2117, which is the which is the bright side of that, actually. So I had posted on Facebook the official NASA picture of the transit. Beautiful image of the sun. You can see the arc of the sun is obviously this huge spherical object, and here's Venus, and it's also this, you know, good sized black marble floating in space in front of it. And I jokingly wrote, yep, that's pretty much what it looked like from here. Now, I did not actually get to see any of the transit, Stephen. I was just wondering, I know you like participating in these things when it's possible. Did you make an effort? Was it visible from where you were? Did you get a chance to look at it?
And yes, and unfortunately now I'm blind. No, no, it's I'm going to depend upon the experts to bring me those pictures. And you're right. Some of these pictures are absolutely stunning. I know that I've seen close-up views, high-definition views of the sun itself, you know, that were as pretty as some of the pictures I'm seeing coming back.
Yeah.
It's like they, okay, this is a special occasion. Let's bring out the big camera, you know, bring out the good equipment. And holding back on just some beautiful, beautiful images.
Absolutely, absolutely. How about you, Paul? Did you get a chance to check out the transit of Venus?
Just online, just what you guys showed me. I appreciate the pics. I even posted it up as my background on my Facebook page, on my personal Facebook page.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's an amazing picture, isn't it? That's quite an image. And it's interesting to me, all these little, like, pictures of a flat yellow circle with a little dot in front of it that you see everywhere. It's really cool to see that image from NASA that just kind of brings the whole dramatic nature of what occurred to life. You know, it's like, well, there it is. There's NASA, or excuse me, there's Venus passing between us and the sun. It's really cool to see it that way, to know that that, you know, happens every now and then. That actually, I was watching not so much the live webcast from NASA as some of the canned videos they had leading up to it, because I kept tuning in to see if there was anything I should be doing or whatever. And they were talking about the history of tracking this transit. And one of the things that's interesting about this is that the transit of Venus is actually the astronomical event that led to the accurate calculation of the astronomical unit. That is to say, the distance from the sun to the Earth, which we know to be 93 million miles approximately, or about 150 million kilometers. And it was through observation of that event and using parallax back in the, I think it was in the 19th century, they tried it in the early 19th century and then were able to finally get the data they needed and do the calculations in the, I think it was like the 1860s, 1870s, something like that. And the astronomical unit was made available, and, you know, is this mainstay of science. This, you know, our understanding of how big the solar system is, you know, all relies on the AU, and that was made possible because of observations that were made around that event. So, pretty interesting historical contribution that event has made to science, in addition to being just kind of one of the more cool things that happened.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, did y'all, in my absence, was the passing of Ray Bradbury mentioned?
We have not discussed that. That was not a surprise, but still something
no.
of a something of a shock, huh?
Yeah, he was 91 years of age. He had a long life, but a very eventful life, and just great author, and one of those guys. He wrote science fiction that was taken seriously, and you know, and in ways that it hadn't been before, and he paved the way for a lot of authors to follow him.
It's true. Well, you know, back in the 50s and the 40s and 50s, he was writing science fiction that was being published in magazines like The Atlantic, rather than in the science fiction magazines. So he was kind of the original guy to bring science fiction sort of into the mainstream. To me, one of the interesting things about him was that he blended science fiction and fantasy very well. I don't know if you ever read Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he didn't care which genre he was working in. He would mix and match as he saw fit, something that Stephen King later adopted. Just not really being concerned about what the genre was, just wanting to tell the particular story that he wanted to tell. But iconic for having, two books that really left a big mark in popular culture, one being The Martian Chronicles, and the other being Fahrenheit 451. That one, I think, is probably more enduring because of its perceived political statement, which is kind of interesting. I was just reading this. P.J. Manny had put a link to a piece in the Washington Post. It was the top 10 Ray Bradbury predictions that came true. And the number one, or actually the first one, I'm not saying it's the most important one, the first one listed here is the people in Fahrenheit 451 Society sport seashells and thimble radios, which bear a striking resemblance to earbuds and Bluetooth headsets. And the second one is members of that society are also obsessed with their large flat-screen televisions, as are today's technophiles. And the viewing screens in Bradbury stories often take up an entire wall. And in fact, I remember in the book, Fahrenheit 451, that's the operation that people keep talking about, the conversion. They're going to have a wall in their house converted to a TV screen. And one of the things that's really interesting about Bradbury is that he was revered as this anti-establishment, anti-government guy writing this book about this totalitarian government that comes and burns people's books. And as far as he was concerned, Fahrenheit 451 was a critique of television. And it was really aimed at TV is destroying books. That was really his point. And to him, the whole police state burning books was just completely incidental to making the point about TV burning books. And apparently that point was pretty much lost on everyone, okay, you know, when the movie was made. And anyone who talks about Fahrenheit 451, it's always this thing about all of the totalitarian government that burns books. I think very much to his frustration that book wasn't understood the way he wanted it to be.
I wonder how he would feel about me reading Fahrenheit 451 on a Kindle Fire. There's some irony there.
He was kind of a technophobe, actually, but I don't think he'd, as long as he got royalties, I don't think he'd have a problem, right?
Yeah.
My favorite Ray Bradbury book. Did you ever read The Illustrated Man? That's the one that I like, the first one of his books that I read, and really stuck with me. The movie was good too, although it was really different from the book. It had Rod Steiger in it. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the book, like The Martian Chronicles, was a novel really made out of him knitting together a bunch of short stories that he wrote. He would take these collections of short stories, and then he would sort of reform them into a narrative structure, and it would form a novel in its own right. It was really good leverage of his material that he was doing, but also made for really different kind of reading. Almost sort of inventing his own literary genre as he went.
I did not read that book. Paul, have you read that one?
No, I did. I have read many of the Martian Chronicles. I may have actually literally cut my teeth on those, something my mom had read and were lying around for quite a while, and one day I actually picked it up and read it.
Yeah, that's a terrific set of stories too. And also, it was originally short stories that became a novel. So anyway, a real groundbreaking figure, terrific imagination, great literary figure. He will definitely be missed. And I guess that marks the end of the great golden age of science fiction authors. You know, if you think about the really big names, they're all gone now. Is that right? Or am I counting someone as dead who's still with us?
Well, Isaac Asimov is gone.
Right. Arthur C. Clarke died, right?
Arthur C. Clarke has passed away just recently.
Yeah.
Heinlein gone.
Yeah, some time ago. And Ray Bradbury. I would say those four are kind of the big ones. And Anne McCaffrey died a while back too. So, well, that's kind of depressing.
Yeah, a little bit. Now let's talk about optimism.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have brought that up. Anyhow.
Oh gosh.
So anyway, Ray Bradbury, you'll be missed. Thank you for
he will be missed.
Fiction.
It was said about him. The director Del Toro said about him that he had a gentle soul, but his imagination was fierce.
There you go.
I thought that was it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Well, I think we've talked through. It seems like there was one or two other news stories we wanted to hit before we jumped into our actual topic this evening, and I'm blanking now.
Well, this is the anniversary. I believe it's the 68th anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And so we like to when anniversaries like this roll around, we definitely want to take a moment just thank the remaining veterans of that and fewer all the time, but thank them for what they did on that day and. That was just awesome heroism, and so. Anyway,
well, a real turning point in the war, absolutely. A real turning point in world history, if you want to look at it that way, occurred that day, and amazing that it was that long ago. I obviously all of us born in the post-war era, but I grew up with it being sort of recent past, and now it's becoming much more remote past. World War II, interesting how the passage of time. That means we're coming up on the 70th anniversary, I guess, in 2 years.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
2014. So that will definitely be a day to mark. And per your point, Stephen, absolutely. Remembrance for those who were lost and who've been lost since, and a big thank you to those who are still with us. All right.
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on. We're going to talk now a little bit about discounting the future. I got this idea. I've been reading, as you know, I've been reading The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. Now, this is not a book about the future per se, and it's certainly not a book about predicting the future or any of the kinds of things that we typically talk about. This is a book about why violence has decreased. And I've been taking my time reading it. It is a well-researched, well-put-together book, and he explores every avenue in trying to come up with the most coherent set of explanations for why violence has decreased. And it turns out to be a fairly complex set of causes. There's a good deal to be said for something that we might just call generally the process of becoming civilized. That seems to have worked in our favor. Commerce has played a large role in making people less violent. The presence of like real institutions, a functioning state, things like that, came along and did it. Lots of other factors, such as people having more leisure time, people becoming more affluent. There are a number of things that you wouldn't immediately make the connection, and then as you start reading, you say, "Oh, I see how this is all working together." Well, I'm in the chapter where he's talking about how big a role self-control has played in people becoming less violent. He's a psychologist. He's a research experimental psychologist. So to him, the whole issue of self-control is very different from the way we think of it, because we tend to think, well, this is something that we actually have. Stephen, we've talked about this a little bit in the context of willpower, right? When you get into this whole discussion about obesity, there's always this issue of, well, if people had more willpower, if they would assert more control over their own lives, their outcomes would be different, and they would enjoy their lives better. It's a thing we tend to assume is real. And so we think, okay, well, one of the reasons that people are more violent now is because they just restrain themselves better, right? It's like they've made a conscious choice, and they say, okay, well, I'm not going to be violent. And so they're not violent. And he's exploring all these aspects of this, and I haven't gotten to the end of the chapter, so I don't know if self-control ends up being completely valid or not. It's interesting how some of these things don't pan out as well as you think. For example, empathy is really important, but according to Pinker, it's probably been overhyped. And I won't get into all the reasons for that, but just to say, that was one of those things where you think, empathy, here we go, PJ, empathy. But it turns out it's kind of a mixed bag. Well, self-control is kind of a mixed bag, too. But anyway, in the context of talking about self-control, he starts talking about our ability to curb our immediate impulses in favor of our long-term desires. And I'm just going to read a couple of passages here from the book, because I think this is very interesting. He says, there's nothing inherently irrational about preferring pleasure now to pleasure later. After all, the U on Tuesday is no less worthy of a chocolate bar than the U on Wednesday. On the contrary, the U on Tuesday is more worthy. If the chocolate bar is big enough, it might tide you over. So eating it on Tuesday means that neither you is hungry, whereas saving it for Wednesday consigns you to hunger on Tuesday. Also, if you abstain from chocolate on Tuesday, you might die before you wake, in which case, neither the Tuesday you nor the Wednesday you gets to enjoy it. Finally, if you put the chocolate away, it might spoil or be stolen, again depriving both yous of the pleasure. All things being equal, it pays to enjoy things now. That is why when we lend out money, we insist on interest. A dollar tomorrow really is worth less than a dollar today, even if we assume there is no inflation, and interest is the price we put on the difference. Interest is charged at a fixed rate per unit of time, which means that it compounds or increases exponentially. That compensates you exactly for the decreasing value of the money coming back to you as time elapses, because the decrease in value is also exponential. Why exponential? With every passing day, there is a fixed chance you die, or that the borrower will abscond or go bankrupt and you'll never see the money again. As the probability that this will not have happened dwindles day by day, the compensation you demand multiplies accordingly. It makes no sense to scrimp all your life so that you can have one hell of a 90th birthday bash. Self-indulgence becomes irrational only when we discount the future too steeply, when we devalue our future selves way below what they should be worth given the chance that those selves will still be around to enjoy what we've saved for them. There's an optimum rate of discounting the future, mathematically an optimum interest rate, which depends on how long you expect to live, how likely you will get back to what you've saved, how long you can stretch out the value of a resource, and how much you would enjoy it at different points in your life. So I read that, and I sat back, and I thought, wow, I had never thought of it in those terms before. I think I had heard the phrase discounting the future before, but I had never I never grasped it before reading this, and I've kind of Googled around. I've been reading up on it a little more since then. But the logic of that is really hard to argue with, so it makes me wonder if we aren't leading people astray here by telling them to focus on the future. Should we actually be telling people to focus more on the present, since the future ought to be discounted to some extent? But then I have another question, and I'll make this a double question rather than a two-parter. To what extent does this apply in an era of accelerating change? So what do you think, Stephen? Are we steering people wrong by making them focus on the future?
Well, the quote that we use all the time, seems like it comes up all the time, is that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed.
Right.
Paul's friend, or someone who laughed at him, I don't know how friendly he was, but, who was laughing about the auto cars, apparently was unaware that they aren't in existence. The future is here in that sense. So when we focus on some of these things that we focus on and we talk about, are just stuff that haven't been adopted yet, and we're looking forward to these things coming about. So not at all. I think in a day and age where we have accelerating technology. Every year that goes by, more and more and more is adopted. More things happen every year within the technological realm. I think it pays to be thinking ahead and not be completely surprised when these things are all around.
What do you think? What do you think, Paul? Are we overvaluing the future on this on this program, and maybe over there at the United Stewardship Alliance?
Well, I think you kind of have to take an individualized approach to the specific thing in which you're referring to when it comes to the activities of the future as opposed to activities presently. There are many activities that while we initially set out to have them be for some future benefit, actually are benefiting us in the present. Anytime we begin to, put forth effort in any given area, we actually become we actually gain a lot from that effort. And you also don't want to, of course, discount the present too much in that if you don't start making, in the United Stewardship Alliance, if you don't start making the changes that you want to today, the tomorrow will never come. And then, of course, you want to do proper risk management. The reason why, we want to save right now when we're younger is because we believe, right, that when we're older, we're going to have a reduced ability to earn money. Our earning potential will decrease when we're older. So the idea is that you want to save now because you're managing future risk. So I think it's going to, whether you're saving for the future financially, whether you're trying to make the future a better place, it really has to happen today. Procrastination is probably the thing that gets us in some of the biggest trouble. I like to play a mind game with myself, and I say I'm going to procrastinate my procrastination. I'll put it off.
I'll put my procrastination off,
and I'll just do it now. So I'm still procrastinating, but I'm just procrastinating my procrastination. So I'll do it now and procrastinate later.
I like it. So you'll put things off tomorrow, but today you'll do stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, there you go. I like it. In the chat room, Sally says, as tech accelerates, the future gets here much, much faster. A nearer future can't be discounted that much. I think that's an excellent point. Also, Paul, I really like your point that the line is not that cut and dried, that some of the things that we do for the future also benefit us now. And, Stephen, you know, we do this show because we enjoy doing it right now. You know, yeah, we're all about making the world a better place, but we look forward to doing this every week. This is a fun thing for us, and presumably the folks who keep listening every week are enjoying it week to week too. So there's something to be said for enjoying the future here in the present, which is different from discounting the future. But I'm glad you mentioned procrastination, Paul, because I think that is a great example of how people discount the future. There's a Ellen DeGeneres has a quote, and I meant to look it up before the show and I didn't, but it's one of the most profound things I think I ever heard. She talks about, you know, the future. The past is gone. The past is gone. It will never be back. And the future, we have no idea what it will be. We don't know if we'll be there for it. It's not real. It's not really here. All we ever really have is this moment. And that's why procrastination feels so right. And I just think that's completely true. You know, it's got that immediate. Yeah, you discount everything else, right? And it's like, well, I'm not going to do that because I want to do something else. So I think it's great, Paul, that you figured out a strategy to use procrastination to put value back into the future by doing what you need to do. I was thinking about other examples of how the future is discounted, and I've got some more. But before I throw
can I
more
jump
out,
in real quick before you do,
yeah.
Can I kind of
oh,
jump
sure.
in?
Yeah,
I think for me the secret to success in life is the right balance between enjoyment, you know, right now, and deferred gratification. If all you do is you know, defer gratification, and you save up all your life for the 91st birthday bash, and you're too old to appreciate it and enjoy it, then obviously that's you've erred on one side. And then the more common error is just living for today and not planning for the future at all.
Right.
Not doing things that are, you know, a little unpleasant right now, like, you know, maybe going to professional school, whatever it is that, you know, it is, you just have to kind of grin and bear it and get it done, better your life. There's just there's a right level of balance. And I think that's the trick, is to find the right level for yourself.
Yeah. Where are you? I mean, to Pinker's point, where you're not discounting the future too steeply, you're not writing too much of it off, because you do want to be around for it later. And also, the one thing that Pinker is not mentioning here, because he's just keeping it pure, because he's talking about these experiments and all this kind of stuff. But he's talking about an individual actor, and to the extent that we're all just individuals pursuing our own goals in life. The discussion is a lot clearer and the lines are a lot crisper than if, say, you're a parent, right? You know, if you have children, then you discount the future in a completely different way than if you don't, because you're all set up around the future in a lot of other ways. You know, you've got all these contingencies about not being there, about where they're going to college, all kinds of things going on that are external to your own thoughts about what's going to happen to you in the future, although completely wrapped up in your own planning for what you're going to do next with your life. And I think you make a really good point, Stephen, that it's somehow you strike the balance between those two. I just have one more, I think, rather humorous example. Have you ever seen the movie, what was it called, Things Change? It was
I don't think so.
Yeah, years ago.
Sounds familiar.
Gangster movie. Anyway, Don Ameche is in it. And there's this scene where he's this old Italian immigrant who's been brought in to claim that he killed somebody he didn't actually kill, and he's going to get money and get sent back to Italy. It is a convoluted plot. Anyway, he's enjoying one weekend in Reno before he goes and testifies and gets the gangster off. And he's sitting in his hot tub with these two beautiful young girls, and he tells the story. We all know the story of the ant and the grasshopper, right? Which is the story of discounting the future, right? The ant carefully stores all his food. He goes out and he works, and he's thinking about winter coming the whole time. The grasshopper, he fiddles, he eats, he enjoys his life. So he tells the whole story. He's got a thick Italian accent. And he tells the whole story exactly as we know it. Winter comes, the ant is well provided for, the grasshopper, he's out in the cold, he's shivering, he's starving, and the final line of the story was, "The grasshopper, eat the ant." Right. So, there's a certain amount of that goes on too. You know, you can plan for all kinds of contingencies, but those who are discounting the future differently than you might make different use of it than you're planning on. So anyway, I was actually about to open up to you guys. Can you think of examples where people discount the future too steeply or not steeply enough?
Well, can I just bring it back one more to that, to what you were talking about, Phil, when you talked about when you bring on children into,
sure,
into the sphere there. I think what you were maybe getting at was taste and preferences. And of course, once you have children, your underlying taste and preferences about what brings you this immediate joy changes.
Yeah.
And I think if we can get that balance, Steve, and life between preparing for the future and enjoying now. When we're able to redefine our tastes and preferences such that what we're doing, no matter what it is, say the ant who's laboring, if the ant really enjoys that laboring, he is actually living for the now.
Right.
And so you can go about doing all these things that you need to do if you can find the enjoyment in it, if you can kind of tweak your own personal taste and preferences. And the more you do that, right, it's like forming a new habit, the more you'll actually begin to enjoy it. I love that TED Talk with that one girl who had lost her legs from the knee down,
yep,
when she was born.
Yep.
And
she's done a whole show about that.
Talked about,
yep. Yeah,
yep. You guys know it. And so she's really been able to form a new taste and preference in life around challenging and how to,
yep,
enjoy the challenges of life. And for her, if you took away all her challenges, she would probably feel not happy anymore. You know, so it's about those taste and preferences that can help create that balance I think Stephen was referring to.
Right.
I think that's a really good point.
Here's what Ray Bradbury, said, he's famous for having said, "Do what you love and love what you do."
Right.
And, you know, that's the idea. I mean, you are saving up for the winter. But if that's what you like to do and you're loving that, then hey, you are accomplishing two things at once, aren't you? You're loving, you're having a good time right now, and at the same time you're building up for tomorrow at the same time. That's a real trick. I mean, that's not everybody and just work all day long. But if you can find a job that you love, find a passion for what it is that you do. I think, that's the real secret, I think.
That's good work if you can get it, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
I think, some examples that have already come up of how people, I think, too steeply discount the future would include procrastinating sometimes. Sometimes we procrastinate, and perhaps we are acting rationally, having the chocolate bar today rather than tomorrow. And sometimes we procrastinate, and we're really putting ourselves in a bad position. And I think, Stephen, it goes back to that striking that balance that you were talking about. Another one that occurred to me, the discussion about the self-driving cars. I would say that an individual who is completely convinced that will never happen is discounting the future in a different way, because that individual is discounting the unfolding possibilities that we're actually facing. I think this is maybe a more serious form of discounting the future, and you see a lot of this. He's not discounting the future; he's discounting the present. Right? This is nearly the equivalent of saying we never went to the moon, right? Or that that the world is flat, right? There are people who discount not just the future, but they discount the actual reality that we're currently living in. And I think a lot of people are future directed in that way, that they don't see solutions, potential solutions to problems that we're currently facing, and therefore they plan all the, you know, they plan all future activity based on the world being the same way that it's that it is now, and so the plans that get put in place are kind of they're kind of fundamentally flawed. One example I would give of this, Stephen, I sent you those two links, and I won't get into the details on either one. I just thought it was really interesting. On the first page of Discounting the Future, I found two different pieces of research about climate change, and one of them said, made the case that we should take immediate and overwhelming action to curb emissions, to follow the entire program, whatever it takes to get this under control, because otherwise we are too steeply discounting the future. If we don't act now, implement carbon controls, the whole program. The other one made the case that no, actually, new technologies are going to completely overcome any of the problems that we're currently having, and we will live in this energy abundant, virtually carbon footprint free future very soon. If we were to take all those steps that the other guys are talking about taking, we would be too steeply discounting the future. So they were making the opposite argument of each other, but both sides of that debate accusing the other of discounting the future too steeply. So it definitely comes down to how much possibility, I guess, we see in the future and how likely we think we are to realize those possibilities.
That's right. If we were to take Pinker's supposition to the extreme and say, okay, if money, he was talking about money and interest. So if money is worth most right now, what you would want to do then, right, is go out and borrow, right, because the future money isn't worth as much. Go out and borrow just as much money as you could possibly get, because that money is going to continually lose value in the future. Of course, there's a whole set of problems that occur in the future then, right? Because
right.
The that accrues with that. But if you were to say today is the most important because this money is not going to be worth as much in the future, then maybe I should just go out and grab up all the money I possibly can right now, take out debt, however it means to get this money, I should do it because it's not going to be worth as much in the future.
Well, and in fact, a lot of people do that, right? That's the rampant credit card debt. And in fact, they're doing exactly what you're talking about there, which is too steeply discounting the future. They're thinking, well, I can buy a bag of, corn chips with my credit card today without thinking about the fact that they're then paying for that for the next 25 years or whatever they end up having to do there. That's a great example.
I had a boss who said he wanted to become a vampire, if there was such a thing, because if you lived forever, you could get out of debt. And then I thought, well, in China, I think, no, is it, no, Japan, or is it China? I can't remember which one. Sorry about that. They have a 100-year mortgage. And
wow.
And how is that possible when lifespans are probably only, 60, 70? It's because they passed on to their kids. So
wow.
Just because we get to a future where we have life extension far beyond our current means doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get out of debt. It might mean that we're going to take these same attitudes that we have now and extend them out even further. So we'll just have larger amounts of debt that we pay off for a longer period of time, maybe.
Imagine if the lifespan is 750 years old rather than 75 years old, the traditional typical mortgage would be 300 years, right? So.
Could be.
Go in and take out that 300-year mortgage. I'm sorry, Stephen, were you going to say something?
No. You guys are right on it. I think I've covered that.
Oh, okay. All right, I thought I talked over you there for a second. I didn't mean to. You know, another one that occurred to me, and this is actually related to the idea of discounting the possibilities. I would come back to that as I think maybe the most serious form of too steeply discounting the future that people do. This movement called Things Will Get Better, encouraging kids who are being bullied not to kill themselves. You talk about the ultimate act of too steeply discounting the future. Suicide has got to be it, right? The decision that if I end it now, I solve all my problems, you know, sounds rational, unfortunately, to some people at the time they make it, because they see no other choice. But the reality is that there are virtually infinite possibilities lying out in front of them, if only they could see them, and if only they could make decisions that would align them with those possibilities rather than put them in a position where they feel like they have no choice. And that's probably the most blatant and shocking example of that. But I think a lot of people do that with their lives anyway. They don't kill themselves, but they just make decisions fairly early on, or even late and middle on, you know, that the future, you know, my life consists of this much stuff, that I do these things, that I know these people, that I go to these places, that I read these books, whatever. And my future will include a bit more of that, and that's all there is to be said about it. And I think that's probably the saddest discounting of the future of all, that people don't recognize how rich their lives can be and how different they could be if they want them to be different from what they are, just by choosing to see some possibilities, choosing to see things a little bit differently than they currently see them.
And I would say it's especially sad when you see it in young people. I've seen, you know, people that are like in high school already discounting, you know, what they can accomplish in their lives because, you know, they may have had a setback, you know, in school. There was one class they had some trouble with, and then they count themselves stupid as a result. And, you know, that's very, very sad to see, you know.
It absolutely is, yeah.
And, you know, I guess it kind of brings us back to what Paul was talking about. It's those people especially. You need to find them some things that you can compliment them on. And you've had enough criticism in your life. Here's some things that you're awesome doing. And, you know, take your focus off the right now. Let's consider how you are good and build on that.
Absolutely. Well, and Paul, I'm going to throw a suggestion out there for you. Maybe a subsequent you challenge might be around helping people to recognize and open up possibilities for themselves and for each other.
I'll have to work on how we can do a trackable challenge.
Okay, cool. Well, we will look forward to talking with you about that further. And it's great having you with us this evening, Paul. Great having you with us on the program, because you're often in the chat room. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate giving me the opportunity to you know, put forth our U challenge a bit more. And I know that just the act of you guys taking a step to let me come on and announce it is helping to make the future a better place. So I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you. All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The music tonight is Arrive by Derek Clegg.
Derek Clegg playing Arrive. All right. Well, thanks, Stephen. Thanks so much for putting that together. And thank you, everyone participating in the chat room this evening, everyone listening to us live, and everyone listening via MP3. We'll be back at the usual time next week. We're going to be talking with the folks from a project called Hybrid Reality, so you don't want to miss that. It promises to be a fascinating discussion. Look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.
love you till I answer why. I got all my nerve and I need to say I'm not looking for a peace of mind. You're not looking to ask me why. Till I asked her why, she said, why? Begging for mercy till I asked her why.